What are the qualities that distinguish an effective evangelist? What are the qualities that distinguish an effective evangelist? Now, lest you think that this is all quite irrelevant to you, let me be quick to qualify my question. I'm not thinking this morning in terms of a formal office bearer in the Church of Jesus Christ. That is to say, for example, a preacher at mass crusades, a planter of local congregations, a missionary who relocates to a foreign field. It's not anything quite so specialized or remote that I'm thinking about at this point. Rather, I'm thinking about the construction worker, the insurance salesman, the registered nurse, the housewife, the high school student. I'm thinking about garden variety people much like you and me, but in particular, those among us who happen to be highly effective in the making known of the Christian gospel. What are the qualities that distinguish such effective gospelizers, if you'd allow me to coin a word? I suppose we could list several. Three, however, immediately leap into my mind. First, effective evangelists are always distinguished by clarity. Have you noticed this? Clarity with the message of the gospel itself? I have never known an exception to this, beloved. Never. People uniquely successful in the evangelistic enterprise are not fuzzy or nebulous with the content of the gospel, but rather are amazingly clear in their explanations of the significance of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Somehow, that message is never confused with morality, religiosity, or political agenda. Rather, the main thing, the gospel, always remains the plain thing. Their gospel conversations are uncluttered presentations of God's good news in Jesus Christ. Effective evangelists are always distinguished by clarity. Secondly, they are always distinguished by sincerity. That is, effective evangelists are always distinguished by an authentic, real, genuine, heartfelt concern for the person hearing that message. Now, I grew up hearing evangelism defined like this. Evangelism is the making known of the gospel message and then leaving the results with God. Now, on the surface of things, that's very fine. What has come to concern me, however, is what's left unsaid in that definition and therefore what it is that can seep in between the lines. The cultivation of an emotional detachment on the part of the Christian, a spirit of indifference to the response of the gospel call. I just share the message, whatever God wants to do with it, so be it. Fine by me. It's an attitude, if I might be so bold, to which people like us are uniquely susceptible. People who have come to appreciate God's sovereignty in its fullness. But God's sovereignty, friends, is no justification for evangelistic indifference, a license for not caring about people. The fact is, you can't really share the gospel Christianly until you feel a measure of sincere concern for the well-being of the one hearing it. It's the very thing, of course, that so clearly distinguished the manner with which Jesus engaged people. Never was there the slightest hint of indifference on his part with regard to the subsequent responses of people. Ha! The Samaritan woman, the rich young ruler, Nicodemus, Zacchaeus, the Roman centurion, the man born blind, I just leave the results with God. If you think about it, my friends, that kind of disposition is in radical incongruity with the gospel itself, isn't it? In other words, to say to a person, you must receive this message as the only source of eternal life, while simultaneously feeling indifferent as to whether or not he ever does, is the epitome of insincerity. Listen to Paul. I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart, for I could wish that I myself were cursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, those of my own race, the people of Israel. My heart's desire and prayer to God for the Israelites is that they may be saved. Do you detect any hint of indifference on his part with regard to the responses of his people? I don't care about results. I could wish that I myself were cursed and cut off. Moreover, friends, do you realize that Paul's heartfelt desire was Jesus Christ's actual experience? For the sake of his people, Jesus Christ was cursed. He was cut off. Was it an act of indifference on his part? A dispassionate sacrifice. Can you imagine Jesus Christ saying, "I don't worry about results"? Of course not. Correspondingly, you see, those who communicate the gospel effectively are not only those distinguished by a clarity with the gospel content, but also a sincerity that is truly Christian, an authentic concern for the well-being of the people to whom they speak. Thirdly, effective evangelists are distinguished by urgency. That is, they are distinguished by a demeanor which conveys the idea that the message of the gospel is to be received at once. That the day of salvation is today. It's now. Now, my friends, I'm not talking about an urgency that crosses over into manipulation. The long, drawn-out altar call, precipitated by the initial going forward of well-coached counselors. The turn or burn scare tactics of the old Chick Tracks or A Thief in the Night movies. I'm talking about the kind of urgency that we see on the pages of the New Testament, friends. A demeanor that clearly communicates the fact that the gospel is not a message with which to be trifled. That it demands a response. I'm talking about an urgency that grows out of the fact that the gospel is not a message that promises to be universally available. You say, what do you mean by that? Oh, I know. You mean that the window of opportunity is only open for the length of a person's lifetime. Available to him up until the moment of his final breath, but then at the point of death, the offer of salvation is eternally rescinded. But are you sure, my friends, that this perspective is an accurate one? You say, well, Art, certainly you've heard of deathbed conversions, haven't you? Of people responding to the gospel at the final moment of their lives? I've heard of such things. But just because such a thing may occur, are we on safe ground to subsequently deduce that every person has the totality of his or her lifetime to respond positively to the gospel? Beloved, according to the record of the Scriptures, there are occasions when God inaugurates the sentence of eternal judgment upon an unbeliever prior to the day of his death. That God himself, in anticipation of final judgment, hardens an unbeliever into a permanent condition of defiant unrepentance. It's as though God says to such a person, "You don't want to believe? I'll grant your wish." And so he takes that human heart and he petrifies it in its sinful and unbelieving condition. It is the very thing that God did to idolatrous Israel, did he not? Isaiah chapter 6. Be ever hearing, but never understanding. Be ever seeing, but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused, make their ears dull and close their eyes. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes and hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and turn and be healed. In the flow of Isaiah, God's message, beloved, is abundantly clear. They don't want me, they want their idols. Therefore, I will grant their desire. Never again will they have me. God then petrifies them in unbelief. The totality of their lives to respond to the message of the gospel? Not in that case. At some point prior to the day of their deaths, in anticipation of final judgment, God, as it were, cast them into eternal darkness. And here's the mind blower. They didn't even know it. They were altogether clueless. They just remained decidedly unbelieving. And of course, we come across the same thing in the gospel accounts, don't we? You remember the end of John chapter 12? After all of the ministry, all of the preaching and teaching, all of the miracles, including, I would remind you, the raising of Lazarus from the dead, John writes, even after Jesus had done all these miraculous signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. And listen to John's commentary, John's explanation. For this reason, they could not believe. Why? John says, God has blinded their eyes and deadened their hearts, so they can neither see with their eyes, nor understand with their hearts, nor turn, and I would heal them. It is, beloved, the petrification of the human heart while it still beats with physical life. God, in an act of judgment, making it impossible for people to respond to Jesus Christ savingly. You remember the Egyptian Pharaoh from the book of Exodus? He sees the great manifestations of the hand of God, doesn't he? And what is his response? After the first several plagues poured out on his people, we read this refrain, but Pharaoh hardened his heart. He knew that this God was God, but he would not yield. Pharaoh hardened his heart. But finally, then, a very interesting change occurs in the text. It begins to read like this. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh hardened his heart. Pharaoh hardened his heart. Pharaoh hardens his heart. God hardens his heart. God himself, making it impossible for Pharaoh to respond to him in any kind of positive way. It is, beloved, the ultimate expression of divine judgment prior to the day of one's death. And this, you see, is why then effective evangelists are always distinguished by a sense of urgency. Not simply because a person might unexpectedly choke to death on his lunch this afternoon, but because God's word is never promised to be universally available. Now, beloved, it's not for us to know when such a thing happens. It's only important for us to know that it does. But how does God do this? The answer, at least in part, is found in the passage that is before us this morning. We see this very thing in the sounding of the fifth trumpet judgment. God, in an act of sovereign judgment, uses the devil and his demons to harden human hearts so they remain in permanent unbelief. Now, if you recall, we've already considered the first aspect of this trumpet judgment, haven't we? In verses 1, 2, and 3, the fifth trumpet sounds and a key is given to a fallen star. The angel of the abyss, it is, as we discovered, Satan himself. In turn, he unlocks the shaft to this inferno, out of which emerges demonic beings, here characterized as locusts, biblical symbols of unstoppable devastation and destruction. But as it were last Lord's Day, we were left a bit hanging, weren't we? That is to say, for what reason are these demonic creatures released? What purpose do these demonic tormentors serve? Last Lord's Day, we considered the origin of these demonic tormentors. For this morning, then, we come to the second of our three headings. Now concerning verses 4, 5, and 6, the mission. The mission of these demonic tormentors. Notice, friends, at the outset, this mission is articulated negatively. That is, it begins with a prohibition. Verse 4. They were told. Remember that from last time? These demons are not operating autonomously, independently, according to their own sovereign designs. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth. Next. Any plant, literally it reads any green thing. Finally, or tree. The idea is, in the original, any tree. In other words, it is a comprehensive prohibition of harm against any form of plant life. Which is very, very strange, considering the fact that these creatures are here referred to as locusts. And by the way, by a sense of comparison, what was it that the locusts destroyed in the Exodus account? They devoured every growing thing in the fields and the fruit on the trees. Nothing green remained on tree or plant. Ironically, however, these are the very things commanded to be off limits to these locusts. The prophet Joel spoke of a locust infestation. We'll talk about this next Lord's Day. These were the terms that Joel used to explain. Despair, you farmers. Wail, you vine growers. Grieve for the wheat and the barley because the harvest of the field is destroyed. The vine is dried up and the fig tree is withered. The pomegranate, the palm, and the apple tree, all the trees of the field are dried up. Now, friends, why then are these the very same things restricted from the locusts here? Because these locusts are not literal locusts, are they? These locusts come out of the abyss, remember? And they have over them the angel of the abyss, the fallen star. As we discovered last Lord's Day, these are demons. They are not, in contradistinction to Hal Lindsey, Cobra helicopters with Stinger missiles. They are demons. Hence, the plague they represent is not agricultural, it is spiritual. Vegetation is not their target, people are their target. A specific kind of people. Now watch, as their mission is articulated more positively. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but the idea is to harm only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. You see, my friends, I've told you this for the last year. In the Revelation, there are two kinds of people. Those who have the mark of God, chapter 7, chapter 14, indicating His divine ownership and protection. And those who have the mark of the beast, chapter 13, reflective of their allegiance to Him. And this is how it works. Those who have the mark of God face the wrath of the beast. And those who have the mark of the beast face the wrath of God. The decision then is very simple. Whose wrath is a person willing to endure? There is no neutrality in the revelation. There is no gray zone in the revelation. No third party into which all of the undecided conveniently fall. Notice here that the mission given to these demonic tormentors is very explicit in terms of its target. Only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. A demarcation is being made. And it reminds us, doesn't it? Of the first Exodus, remember? Who suffered from the plagues of God's wrath? The enemies of God's people. What about God's own people? They were preserved, weren't they? Protected in Goshen from the wrath of God. And now, you see, in this replay of the plagues, it's the same thing here. Only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. In other words, Christian, take comfort from this. Huh? Christians never need fear the experience of this judgment, the afflictions of these demonic tormentors. Why? God Himself, as the sovereign author and originator of this judgment, is the one who determines the boundaries of it. He paints the bullseye on those who will be its targets. Only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Now, by the way, friends, as a little sidebar to my way of thinking, this is one of the strongest arguments against the idea that Christians can be demonically controlled. Some of you, no doubt, have been in church contexts that have sought to define the struggles of Christians as the consequence of demonic invasion and inhabitation. And so you've been told things like this: we must cast out the demon of depression. We must cast out the demon of doubt, the demon of despair. We must cast out the demon of materialism. We must cast out the demon of bitterness. Now, my friends, that entire idea is flawed at a great number of points, not the least of which is the complete disregard for the fact that by God's own design here, Christians have been marked with a seal that serves to secure them from the independent assault of demonic forces. But you see, because we've been taught to think of this seal business as a microchip implanted underneath the skin of our foreheads during the final 7 years of the Great Tribulation, we've missed altogether, you see, the present and powerful significance of this sovereign limitation established by God Himself. Here is our protection, beloved. How was it that Jesus prayed for us in John 17? My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but you protect them from the evil one. I want to ask you, are the prayers of Jesus Christ effectual or not? What does 1 John say about the one who has been born of God? The evil one cannot harm him. Friends, we gotta crush this dualism underneath our foot. The target of these demonic tormentors has been determined by God Himself. Only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. But not only does God restrict the targets of this judgment, His sovereignty expresses itself in the nature of its intensity. Look at it. They were not given authority to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. Now, at first blush, this appears to be a significant limitation on this judgment. They're not allowed to kill, only to torture and torment. But the fact is, as we discover in the very next verse, the severity of this judgment is defined precisely because these demons do not bring about death. You know what this is, beloved? It is truly an anticipation of the lake of fire. A place that will be characterized by unending torment. Not the cessation of existence. You say, well, what about this business of 5 months? They were not given the power to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. What's the significance of these 5 months? Why 5 months? What are we talking about here, friends? Demons characterized as locusts. The lifestyle of a locust is the life cycle of a locust is 5 months. In other words, the length of this inflicted torment corresponds to the existence of the locusts themselves. You say that these aren't literal locusts. Right, they're demons. And in contrast to the fiction of Frank Peretti, demons do not cease to exist. Which means what? That the length of this demonic torment corresponds to the existence of the demons themselves. In other words, these torments will be inflicted upon people throughout the entirety of this epoch between the first and second comings of Jesus Christ. More personally, it means that once a person has been marked out as a target for this demonic torment, there will be no relenting of it. So this begs the obvious question. What is this torture inflicted by these demons? Well, first of all, beloved, take note of its graphic description. And the agony they suffered was like that of the sting of a scorpion when it strikes a man. Now again, beloved, like so much of this is Exodus language. Throughout the wilderness wanderings, we read this in the Old Testament. The people of God encountered scorpions. Scorpions and snakes often mentioned together. To speak of the difficulties that were encountered throughout their journey to the land of promise. In fact, there was a place actually in the process of that journey that was called the Scorpion Pass. And so, for example, Moses says of God's protection, He led you through the vast and dreadful desert and thirsty and waterless land with its venomous snakes and scorpions. These were lobster-like creatures, about 4 to 5 inches long, with a claw on the end of its tail that secreted a poison to be injected into its victim in much the same way that a snake injects poison through its fang. Rarely fatal, the pain inflicted by these scorpions was said to be excruciating. Now, what is very interesting to discover is when we come to the New Testament, Jesus himself speaks of snakes and scorpions and refers to them as demons, over which his followers have power, but which can still harm unbelievers. So what is this torment here? This torment that is likened to the sting of a scorpion. Well, the word itself, torment, is used to speak of severe distress, of violent harassment, torture of the most unrelenting kind. Occasionally, rarely in the New Testament, it is used to speak of physical suffering. But far more common, my friends, is the idea of a torment that is spiritual and psychological. For example, in Matthew chapter 8, the demons say to Jesus, "Have you come here to torment us before the appointed time?" Now, obviously, that torment is spiritual and psychological, given the fact that demons are immaterial creatures. In 2 Peter chapter 2, we're told that Noah, seeing the lawlessness of his day, was tormented in his righteous soul. Keep your finger here and turn over to chapter 11. Chapter 11 is distinguished by the witnessing of two witnesses, indicative of the witnessing ministry of the Church of Jesus Christ. The kind of opposition they run up against. Verse 7 says, "Now when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them and overpower and kill them. Their bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. For 3.5 days, men from every tribe, people, tribe, language, and nation will gaze on their bodies and refuse them burial. The inhabitants of the earth," we know that phrase, "will gloat over them and will celebrate by sending each other gifts." Why? Because these two prophets had tormented those who lived on the earth. It's not a physical torment, beloved. It is a spiritual and psychological torment. In fact, throughout all of the Revelation, this word is used to speak of torment that is associated with the final judgment, but in a way that is primarily spiritual and psychological, not physical. In other words, beloved, this is a torment of the mind and the soul rather than the body. So let me tell you what I think this is. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, Moses predicts that in the latter days, Israel will suffer the plagues of Egypt, including a locust plague, interestingly enough, because of her idolatry. But these plagues, as you read Deuteronomy 28, will not primarily be physical. The affliction will cause a torment that is much more spiritual and psychological. Listen to this. Listen to this. "The Lord will afflict you with madness," some translations say insanity, "blindness, confusion of mind. You will grope like blind men in the darkness. You will be filled with an anxious mind, a despairing heart, never sure of your life." In other words, the torment will be far more spiritual and psychological than physical. This torment leveled against idolaters. And now, beloved, I ask you, what is the primary sin in the book of Revelation? Idolatry. In fact, every other sin that appears in this book is mentioned because of its association with idolatry. Who, in fact, are the targets of this judgment? Only those who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. But they also go by another name, don't they? Back up in chapter 8, verse 13, they are referred to as the inhabitants of the earth, a technical term in the Revelation for idolaters, those who belong to this world system and worship the beast. Well, you see, upon these idolaters, just like those mentioned in Deuteronomy 28, there is inflicted upon them an unrelenting torment that is psychological and spiritual. In fact, you'll note that it's hinted at in the couplet that appears in verse 6. The way it reads is in a poetic phraseology. They will seek death, but will not find it. They will long to die, but death will elude them. It is a poetic way of saying their spiritual and psychological torment will fill them with such despair that they will wish they no longer lived, and yet simultaneously will be unwilling to commit suicide. It's not a torment of the body, beloved. It is a torment of the mind and the soul. Now, friends, I ask you to remember what this is. It is a replay of the Egyptian plagues. And what do we know to be true about those plagues? All of them were God's way of displaying His power over the specific gods of Egypt. And what ensued from that judgment? Spiritual and psychological breakdown on the part of the Egyptians. Remember? The court magicians come to acknowledge that Yahweh is God. The political officials come to acknowledge that Yahweh is the one true God. The people themselves beg the Israelites to go and in fact give them all of their gold, all of their silver, all of their clothing, and they say, get out of here before we all die. Pharaoh himself finally acknowledges that he had sinned, that Yahweh was the one true God. The entire nation therefore comes to realize that the whole of their religious convictions had been nothing but misdirected vanity. And yet, despite their open acknowledgement of there is truth, but there is no turning to God. It's torment, you see, the agony of a mind and soul knowing the truth without the ability to embrace the truth because God, in an act of final judgment, has petrified the heart. This, you see, in this replay of the Exodus, is what John has in mind right here. The only difference here, beloved, is that the veil is pulled back. And as a result, we come to discover the means God uses to bring about such ends. In an act of judgment, in anticipation of the final judgment, God uses the influence of the demonic realm to keep people in the darkness despite their overwhelming misery. It reminds me of the scene in Pilgrim's Progress when Christian is taken into the interpreter's house and he sees a man in an iron cage. And Christian asks him, why don't you get out? He says in response, I can't get out. Yes, you can. No, I can't. Christian says, but God is merciful. God will forgive you. He will not forgive me, the man in the cage responded. Why not, exclaims Christian. Because, says the man in the cage, I won't repent. And Christian leans over to the interpreter and says to him, why has God done this? And the subtle response given by John Bunyan reveals his understanding of how such a thing happens. Bunyan writes, God is not the one who shut him in a cage. Satan is the builder of such cages. And that, beloved, is what this is. God, to be sure, commissioning the evil one in all of his wickedness to create such hardness of heart that turning to God for salvation is impossible, despite the acknowledged agony of remaining confined to such a miserable condition. You know what dawned on my mind this past week? What an incredible irony this is. Here, Satan is allowed to release his demonic hordes, but not to torment his enemies, the servants of God who are shielded by the seal of God, but to torment his own allies, those who bear his seal, the inhabitants of the earth. I want to tell you something, friends. Not only does this tell us something about the sovereignty of God, that as we said last week, He uses evil to punish evil, it tells us something significant about the wickedness of Satan himself. When given the opportunity, he will not reward his loyal subjects with pleasure and satisfaction, as he so often promises. He will reward them with torment and torture.
People often joke about hell as being a place where all the sinners in the world will be able to eventually enjoy all of their wickedness for eternity, led into such indulgence by the devil himself. But let me tell you something, my friends. Satan does not just hate the people who love God. Satan hates the people who hate God. Having been given over to evil in the fullest sense, Satan hates everything and everyone and will only be a source of eternal misery for those who, in refusing the gospel, will endure eternity with him. If the thing that ultimately defines heaven to be heaven is being in the immediate presence of God forever, then it is equally true that the thing that ultimately defines hell to be hell is being in the immediate presence of Satan forever. You see the irony here, beloved. People who stake their confidence in the idolatries of this world will inevitably experience the torment of being afflicted by the very source of their idolatries. You say, well, Art, does this kind of thing actually happen today? Absolutely, positively it does. You say, well, when in the life of an unbeliever does it happen? I don't know. Does it happen to every non-believer? No, but it does happen, I am convinced, more often than we realize. I think I've seen it, beloved. And I bet there are many of you here this morning who have seen it too. You just didn't know how to define it. You know this person. I know this person. I've seen this person in my office 100 times. It's the man or woman who talks to you, who is suffering from all of the miserable effects that accompany a life without God. And you come along, and you know precisely what they need. And so you share the gospel with such a person. You tell them the good news. You speak of how the grace of God transformed your life and rescued you from the abyss. And all the while, knowing what you know about God's great gift of salvation, you fully expect that upon hearing this, such a person will gladly, right now, forsake everything in his life to have this salvation. Here's what you need. Here's the answer to the real question in your life. This is how you can have peace with God through Jesus Christ. But then it absolutely blows you away when in response, they just kind of rub their forehead and say, I don't know. And you find yourself wanting to shake such a person and say, why will you not believe? This is everything you need. They readily acknowledge their hopelessness. They openly acknowledge their despair, the emptiness, the fear. You tell them with even greater passion, turn from your sin and embrace Jesus Christ. Holiness and happiness are found in Him. But the one solution to their lives, so obvious to you, they just can't bring themselves to embrace. Now, what I'm telling you, friends, is that sometimes this is more than just the fallenness that is endemic to every member of the human race. Sometimes this is an anticipated expression of the final judgment of God. Sometimes it's the sting of the scorpion, the consequence of something demonic, a heart that has been petrified before the great and final day. If you are a Christian, this is a judgment that you need never fear. God has sealed you. You are His. Never, never fall prey to the evil one by overestimating the harm he can bring into your life. You say, but Art, I'm not a Christian. I'm a son of Christian parents. I'm a daughter of Christian parents. I obviously attend this Christian church. Maybe I even attend a Christian school. But I myself, I'm not a Christian. And so what must I do in the face of such potential judgment? Oh, my dear friend, the very fact that you ask this question indicates that this has not yet befallen you. What must you do? The answer, my friends, is very simple. Respond to the command of the gospel of Jesus Christ immediately while the day of salvation is still available to you. Turn from your sin, young men and women, and embrace Jesus Christ without delay at this very moment while the door remains open to you. If it's one thing we can deduce from the scriptures, it is this. The people to whom this kind of thing happens most frequently are those who have been exposed to the greatest amount of gospel light. If God has sealed you as belonging to Him, you will come. And so I implore you now, young men and women, boys and girls, adults, I implore you now, with clarity and sincerity and urgency, come to Jesus Christ right now. Cry out to the Lord and say, "Save me." And He will. He will not turn you away. He will receive you. Come before it's too late to come. For some, it is already too late. Would you bow your heads with me, please?